So I think I want to begin by reiterating something Megan said about the fact that your brain is always changing. Everything you do and experience is having an impact on your brain and how you'll function in the future. You know, even just sitting there and listening to this talk is hopefully having a positive impact on your brain, but that's yet to be determined. So that also, means that bad things can happen to your brain. And there's been a lot of concern recently that maybe, you know, Google is making us stupid because we don't have to remember things, and we can be distracted constantly by the internet and all of the information there. Of course, lots of people believe that the reality television is doing some bad things to us also. We elected him a couple times. There's just accumulating evidence that we might be getting more stupid. So we could worry, but I actually think that we're getting smarter. If you look at IQ scores over the past 100 years, they tend to be increasing pretty steadily over the years. In fact, it looks like each generation is improving by about 10 IQ points. And as a result, we've needed to continue to adjust the IQ scales to make them still valid. It's called the Flynn effect, and it's not really understood how it works. One thing we do know is it's not due to evolution or genetic change, because it's just too short of a time period. So it's got to be something in the environment is changing our IQ and making us smarter. So the question comes up, how do we make sure we're promoting good change and moving in the right direction? So one way is to train very deliberately the skills that you want to have and be good at. And you can begin by improving the really fundamental abilities, things that underlie more important skills. These are areas like your sensing, processing information quickly, remembering information, paying attention to it. And as you train those things, you can improve the higher order abilities that sort of rest on top. Does my microphone sound weird? Am I sort of lisping? Okay, cool. So cognitive training is the approach that my company takes, Lumosity.com. We have a website where you come and do exercises on a daily basis to train your cognitive abilities. They range across a bunch of different sort of fundamental abilities so that they'll translate to broader ones, like some of those areas. And we work with, you know, third-party collaborators, people in academics, to study the impact of our training programs. So we're now at about 20 million people. There's a little bit more than that now. And that brings up a really exciting opportunity as a scientist. We are collecting tons and tons of data right now on cognitive performance, how different people perform, how their performance changes as a result of the things that they do and things in their life. So we're calling this the Human Cognition Project. This is basically our effort to better understand how human cognition works and how we can improve it by taking advantage of this database and the academic collaborators that we work with. So I'm going to show some new results today, things that we have been analyzing for the past couple months and are just about to publish next week, but they haven't been released yet. So as we're tracking the cognitive performance across all these people, we have a ton of information about how well do they perform across a broad range of different abilities and tasks. What we didn't know initially was what else is going on in their life away from the computer. So we surveyed 750,000 people, a few more than that, and asked them a whole bunch of questions about their diet, their lifestyle, how much exercise they get, and what type of exercise. And we compared that data with their cognitive performance data in order to figure out how do these things correspond. Of course, we need to control for some factors that we already know are going to affect their cognitive performance. So the first question, how much sleep do you typically get in a night? Let's see. Cool. Let me see. I'm going to use the mouse. So, thanks. Not too surprisingly, as you get more sleep from being sleep deprived, your performance improves. This particular chart is showing your performance in math and problem solving, but the same pattern is true across memory and speed as well. What's a little bit more surprising is that after about 7 hours of sleep on a regular basis, people's performance is actually declining. We don't know exactly why that is, but it's pretty interesting to see that there's this actual peak at around 7 hours of average sleep. I last night was at about 4 or 5, so I'm hoping to adjust that as the week goes forward. Another question we ask is, how much do you exercise each week? And as you can see, if you don't exercise at all or very rarely, you have a significantly worse average cognitive performance than everybody else. But what else is interesting is, as you get up to just about 2 days a week, you're already at about the same level as people that exercise 6 days a week. It's important to be healthy. This is something that we know. You know, we see that things that are good for your heart are also good for your brain. Just a little bit. It's a moderate exercise is fine. It kind of gives you the full benefit of for brain performance and mental health. There are a lot of ideas about how this may be working. One of the more interesting ones is that due to aerobic exercise, especially running and other weight-bearing aerobic activities, you're actually growing more new neurons. Unclear if those neurons are very important, but it's pretty neat. It helps me for motivation to know that if I go out for a run today, I'll create a few thousand extra neurons. This one I thought would be pretty relevant at the beginning of the conference. We asked people how much they drink on average. Keep in mind, this is not immediately after a drink you perform better, but rather, if you on a regular basis consume one or two drinks, your performance actually appears to be slightly better than people that don't drink at all. Now, I'm not going to actually take a stance and recommend that you begin drinking if you don't already. As you can see, as you get out beyond a few drinks per day, the performance declines, and I'm sure it goes down a lot more after 7 drinks a day. So what we're looking at here is your memory performance as a function of how much you drink on a regular basis. We also looked at this for speed and math and problem solving. And it's a similar curve. However, with speed, you can see the peak is actually a little bit further out. It's it takes about 4 or 5 drinks per day on average until you're performing at the teetotaler level. this is not as surprising. People that read perform better cognitively. We weren't very surprised by that. Also, people that play a musical instrument are performing slightly better than people that don't. That's it. Cool. Those are just a few of the findings that sort of popped out when we looked at the survey of results. And I think one of the takeaways broadly is that moderation in most of these domains is totally reasonable. And I mean, a lot of us sometimes feel guilty about having, drinks now and then and maybe not getting enough sleep. And it is important to get enough sleep and not to overdrink and to exercise. But you also don't need to do anything very extreme in order to have all of the cognitive benefits. So now I'll pass it off to Dan.
I can actually bring that over. It's going to be a little easier.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Mike, thank you for making me feel good about having a few drinks tonight. And then the exercise, can I do that after I get home?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, Mike told you about this Flynn effect, the general increase of IQ over the course of several decades. I get to tell you a little bit about how technology might continue the advance of our improved cognition. So, I've been thinking about cognitive enhancement both in health and disease, with drugs and with technology, as a neuroinnovation fellow at Stanford, and as a co-founder of a new company called Sheepdog Sciences. The take-home that I want you to leave this room from my few minutes here is that I believe the future of mind hacking will leverage what our brains do well to compensate for what our brains do poorly. So let me illustrate exactly what I mean by this. I generated a simple aspirational phrase about mind hacking. With the right mind hacks, I can be like Jason Bourne. Then I wrote it on a cue card. like a proper scientist and quantifier. I timed myself. It took a little more than 20 seconds, and it was pretty legible. Then I did it again. This time I closed my eyes. I got all the words on the card, thankfully, but they run together. The lines are sideways. The exclamation point and the parentheses somehow found their own little domain on the card, and it's clearly there's something wrong here. So, what's happening? I've been handwriting for decades. This is not some new task I'm working on. Why is this the case? So, the reality is, this is because of something that our brain does not do very well. Our sense of joints in space, the sense of our position of our body, is not very good. This sense called proprioception is not as good as our visual accuracy of detecting where our joints are in space. So, in fact, there's been some recent studies that quantified this, and it turns out you're twice as good detecting, in terms of accuracy, the position of your joints in space with your eyes than with your joints and your body themselves. Now, this is significant in my opinion because this is a domain where our bodies don't do very well, but external sensors like video cameras with image processing can do this very effectively. So, for a few $100 off the shelf, you can buy a Microsoft Kinect. Turns out the Microsoft Kinect at 2 meters has almost exactly the same angular resolution as your joints themselves. Now, if you go a little more high-end to a high-speed motion tracking system that uses fiduciary markers, you can get much higher spatial and temporal resolution so that Joe Mauer can have a much better insight about the dynamics of his swing from the motion capture system than he can by doing it himself. And so one of the key futures for cognitive enhancement, in my opinion, and one that I hope all of you can contribute to in the coming years, is a framework that goes something like this. In one more slide. What we want to be is a little bit like Jason Bourne. We want to have that superior reaction time and peak athletic performance. I'm going to talk a little bit about decision making and how we can use the right part of our brains to do that well. I'm going to touch a little bit on how you can maybe get the girl as well, but there's no guarantees there. And ideally, this is something that I want to see become increasingly more pervasive in our society. And a lot of it is going to depend on mobile and technology and the things that many of you are great experts at. So, what are these three steps framework that I envision? So, the first is a step of measurement and detection. So, this might be direct measurements of brain activity using EEG sensors on the scalp, or they could use external systems like the motion tracking of Joe Mauer. Then there's an important intermediate step where these data are processed and analyzed, where we find signals in the EEG, where we remap things that we're not very good at, like proprioception, onto things that we're better at, such as our visual system. And then we reintroduce this to ourselves in a modified format, or even better, with non-invasive targeted brain stimulation that could use electrical or magnetic fields, or even in the future, targeted ultrasound. Here's a great example that's currently available that achieves this very thing. It's called the BrainPort. It's made by a company in the UK called YCAB, and it's used to help people with vestibular problems maintain their balance. And it works pretty simply. There's a processor unit and then a little tongue-based tab, that's the one with the gold dots over there in the image, that has about 100 electrodes. There's also an accelerometer in that little tongue unit, and when the patient tilts to the side, the unit transmits a specific pattern of signals to that tongue stimulator, which is a signal for the subject or patient to right themselves to keep Mona Lisa from falling off the canvas and onto the floor of the museum. Another fantastic example of something that our body does poorly that can be easily compensated for with technology. The Avicor system very efficiently extracts heat from the body. It was invented by Craig Heller at Stanford, a collaborator and good friend. And this is fantastic for two reasons. First of all, our brains don't work very well when we're warm. We get cognitive deficits starting about 101 degrees. And this is something that's an issue for athletes making bonehead mistakes at the end of games and for first responders and people working in hot environments. More importantly, this is a limitation. This heat is a limitation for athletic performance. Craig Heller himself on his 60th birthday did 1,000 push-ups. And this device is used by special forces, Olympic, professional, college athletes all over the world. At my company, we're addressing a different deficit that we have. We'd like to have better memories. And so what we're thinking about is a system in developing, a system that will help choose which memories stick. In other words, imagine if you could unmelt some of those clocks from DALI's persistence of memory. And it works by targeting a portion of our memory cycle that occurs between when you encode and study something and when you retrieve it. And this is known as memory consolidation. It's something that's been rather extensively studied by neuroscientists and is, in general, just a hot topic right now. We know it occurs preferentially during sleep. It requires the replay of neural activity. And without it, your memories just aren't there in the morning. So our company is developing a system for the consumer market that achieves an improvement of memory consolidation. And our prototype device has shown a significant enhancement of 20% without drugs or any type of dangerous stimulation. So this is something that we're working on hard right now, and keep an eye on our website for more information in the coming months and years. An important domain that can be improved in the future, and one that I'm very excited about, has to do with making better decisions. And we are just not very good at making decisions in the short term that have long-term effects. And dieting is a perfect example. So there's two images on the screen. Which is going to be harder to resist? That barbecue sandwich from down the street is probably the one that's going to be tougher than the cigar on the left. Well, it turns out that that cigar on the left is also a pulled pork sandwich, one that's been created by the molecular gastronomists Hamaro Kantu and Ben Roche. And they created it because they wanted to have a fine dining experience that generated a dissonance between what you see and what you taste, which is fantastically cool. But I also want to think about it, that as a system, as the basis for a system that helps guide our food choice decisions. So how might this work? Imagine a closed-loop brain stimulation system for better decision-making. It incorporates diet, social, personal goals, medical needs like allergies. It has image analysis to see what food is in front of you, location awareness to recognize that you're in McDonald's and not in the farmer's market. And it can track physiological things like weight, glucose, exercise, alcohol intake. Integrate that information and feed it back to targeted brain stimulation at areas that we know affect our decision-making processes and allow us to have a crutch of sorts to make better decisions. So, lest I leave you with a future of brain stimulation and cognitive enhancement in which you don't get to eat that plate of cookies, let's talk one final hope that the orgasmatron is coming. Now, this is something that has a long history, and in the post-war years, Wilhelm Reich, a Freudian psychoanalyst, is one who really pushed these sorts of ideas. He believed in a sort of celestial force that he called orgone energy that he purported could be concentrated in these very solitary and frankly not very sexy orgone boxes that are shown there on the right. The concept had a bit of a better take in Woody Allen's 1973 sleeper movie, but in the future, we might be able to actually achieve this through targeted brain stimulation of areas known to be involved in sexual arousement, which is shown in this functional brain imaging slide here, as well as peripheral stimulation. So that's certainly something to look forward to. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Dave Asprey. We're going to talk about biohacking, and mostly things I've done and things you can do to upgrade your head today using technologies besides smart drugs. This is a picture of me in a 64 node headnet for EEG. I did that on a weekend for fun. And biohacking is something that I've been doing for about 15 years. And I've defined it, I actually wrote the Wikipedia entry for it, about the art and science of using technology to control the state of your body and of your mind. It turns out, if you do this, you get things that a lot of us are looking for, like smarter, stronger, faster, sexier. I'm still working on that one. And what it really leads to is transformation. If you can't read the fine print that says, at your own risk, you guinea pig you. So the current state of some of this stuff is prototype at best, but it can be made safe at least most of the time. The reason I do this today is because I've led an unusual life. When I was 22, I was the first person to sell any physical good over the internet. That's me in Entrepreneur Magazine. I had all the symptoms of Asperger's syndrome, which is on the autism spectrum, related to ADD, things like that. And I weighed almost 300 pounds. I usually round up. And I started biohacking myself. I work out a lot, you know, eat less. It doesn't work, but I tried. 4 years later, a lot of stress. My brain starts misfiring, and I use one of the first quantified self tools out there, FreeCell. How many of you know FreeCell? It's a solitaire game that comes on Windows PCs for free, but every game can be solved. And what I found by graphing this out was that on some days I couldn't really do it. It took 3 times longer than other days. And it turns out my performance cognitively was very different on different days. The problem here, I'm still fat, but now the stupid's coming, and all of my seventh grade peers apparently were right. So I started hacking my brain too. This is a picture of my brain scans. It may be a little tough to read in the back of the room. I apologize. That's actually a scan of the doctor's report. It says things like decreased perfusion in the prefrontal cortex. There was another page that wouldn't fit on here. And worst of all, this is what the brain imaging guy said. I'm an interesting referral. When you have pictures of your brain, that's not the words you really want to hear. Today, you can get this scan done yourself. This is a SPECT scan. It costs you about $2,500. I spent about $4,000 more than a decade ago. Now, going in about 10 years and about $250,000 spent on upgrading myself later, well, our fonts changed colors. It used to be a white font. My career is awesome. I've run strategy for 2 different companies with more than $1 billion in revenue. 3 startups I've worked for have been acquired. I've worked on Sand Hill Road as a venture capitalist. I'm a dad. My blog is very well trafficked about biohacking. Like, everything is going as well as I could possibly hope. On top of that, I'm about 210 pounds. My IQ is, depending on how you measure it, probably about 30 points higher than it used to be, and I don't think I was particularly dumb to start. My vision is better, my hearing is different, and my memory works better than it did before. Here's the 10 technologies that have made the most difference. The first one here is called heart rate variability. This goes back more than 15 years. The device you're seeing here is called the M-Wave. And it turns out that your heart talks to your brain. So there are a lot of connections that go from right here to right here. But 80% of them are actually sending data from your heart into your brain, not from your brain to your heart. So your brain doesn't control your heart that well. It turns out that I have actually started, as I look at biohacking, to look at the heart and the gut as kind of inseparable from the brain. Neither of them works very well without the other one. The way this communication happens is neuroelectric. There's hormones. There's something called a pulse wave. It's mechanical. And there's an M field, an electromagnetic field. All 4 of those communicate, 4 ways of communicating are separate and different. So what you want to do is you want to hack your heart and your nervous system first if you want to actually hack your brain. This is a picture of my heart rate variability. Variability itself means you look at the space between heartbeats and you graph out that space, and you want the space to be very different and very rhythmic. On the left side up there where it says coherent, that's when I'm actually doing a 5 second in, 5 second out breathing exercise. This is what my heart rate variability looks like. On the right side is when I stop doing that and I allow the system of my body to become more chaotic. It turns out the state on the left corresponds with higher alpha in the brain as well as a meditative state. The cool thing is, $200 device will turn green when you're doing it right, and it turns red when you're doing it wrong. You don't have to believe in Buddha. You don't have to do yoga, no wearing loincloths. It's green or red, your choice. From a software training perspective, I'm a big fan of something called dual in-back training. And I apologize, the slides are so dark. The fonts did something strange. Dual in-back training is the equivalent of weight training for your brain. There are lots of really fun and stimulating exercises, and I would say dual in-back training is the exact opposite of that. It is boring, and frankly, it pisses you off when you try and train your brain to have more working memory. It's uncomfortable. What you do, this is a screenshot of an Android app and a PC app that I've got. It's called Bulletproof Mindwear, and it's a simple 3x3 grid, and different squares will light up, and as each square lights up, a voice will say a letter. And you need to remember, where were the squares and what letters have you heard before? And if you heard one of those before and it repeats, you press a button. It sounds boring and repetitive, it is, but in 10 to 20 hours of training, I see people routinely on the blog who are getting 12 additional IQ points, 20 additional IQ points, because what it's doing is it's teaching you to remember a string of numbers here and a string of numbers here. So now you have two strings to play with. It makes a huge difference. On top of that, I used focused creative attention training, which allows you to very effectively remember what happens when you're in those really altered states, like a dream state, the daydreaming state. Most of us have amazing things happening in our unconscious mind, and we have no bridge between the unconscious and the conscious mind. There's software here that's designed to help you remember as you're in those altered states so that you can bring forth what your creative unconscious mind is already doing for you today. If you look at these states, we have delta through beta, and the idea here is you simply learn how to remember what happened there. It's already happening, you just don't know it. Costs about $50. Next, electrical stimulation. TDCS, you saw a photo of us doing already. This runs a current from one place on your brain to another. This puts you in a flow state, that state where you can just get stuff done. You can get it for about $99 in a do-it-yourself kit. This is a picture from GoFlow, the guys who make that. It's literally a 9-volt battery with a limiter for the current hooked up to your brain. Then we have cerebral electrical stimulation, or CES, which has been around for a long time. The Russians used it because they figured it was cheaper to let the astronauts sleep less than it was to send more astronauts into space. It makes you more creative, it lets you get more recovery in less time while sleeping, and it increases frontal alpha in the brain, that relaxed, focused state you want to have. I do experiments like doing heart math with CES running to see what happens, and there's definitely a change in how my body functions when I do this. You're looking at about $100 for TDCS, $500 for CES. This is not more than a Lexus. Direct stimulation gets riskier. I have a far infrared LED stimulator. You cannot buy this on the market today. You can make it for about $20. More than 2 minutes over a single spot in the brain might actually hurt your brain physically. Be careful. But other than that, it increases mitochondrial function. It has very noticeable effects on the brain. Just don't leave it there for too long, including cell division, regeneration. And I have a laser that's actually less dangerous than the infrared here that does similar types of things. A laser is $2,500. They use it in the Army Special Forces to speed healing of wounds, particularly like knee wounds, joints. And $20 if you want to build your own thing. Next, neurofeedback. You can control your brain. You actually can teach your brain how to organize itself, or your brain will do it even without you consciously knowing what's happening. Your brain doesn't have a mirror. If you can give your brain a way to know what's happening, it will self-optimize without you trying. There are big questions here about what protocols you should use, and this is an area where data, big data, becomes very important. The protocols that I used have been proven to raise your IQ by 12 points in an NIH-backed study. However, the system that I use costs nearly $20,000 because the protocols are secret. There's a picture of my alpha waves before and after. You can buy your own unit at home for $1,000 without protocols. You can pay someone who has lots of good protocols. Next up, what if you didn't worry about electricity, you just look at blood flow? So what we'll do here is you look at blood flow in the front of your brain, and you can do feedback. This is Jonathan Tooman, who's a pioneer in HEG. His grandfather actually invented it, and that's a prototype unit you can buy for about $500. I have one on order. As soon as it comes out, I'll be using it. Light affects your brain. Raise your melatonin levels by wearing cool orange glasses at night. Sounds crazy? It'll affect your sleep very dramatically. Change your light bulbs to not be compact fluorescents. Use halogens or LEDs because that also affects your consciousness. Finally, sound entrainment. We have monaural beats, you know, shamans drumming. This is the oldest brain hacking technique known to man. Raves do the same thing, by the way. There's binaural beats. This is also very old. Those ringing bells or monks chanting different sounds in different ears, your brain enters an altered state when that happens. I use isochronics and white noise in the software I've got. We're looking $0 to $250, not expensive brain hacking technologies at all. Finally, if your hardware isn't working, upgrading your software in your brain doesn't work very well. A very high-fat, low-toxin diet, I have one defined on my blog, really turns on your prefrontal cortex, which is what you want. And life is not complete without coffee, which gives you the same mental state as Qigong, improves your memory, improves your exercise performance, makes you lose weight, and makes you actually gain muscles. Priceless. But everything here, about $10,000. That's what it'll cost you to do the full stack here. This is not a huge amount of money for the amount of transformation that you can have in relative short order, and I highly recommend you start playing now.
Let's go one more. Are we on? Yeah. Okay, so we're going to have question time now, so if you guys have questions, please come up to the mic, and I'm going to kick it off with a question that might be on people's minds, that's certainly on mine. I'm wondering if you guys can speak to the potential ethical concerns of brain hacking. Like, what happens when we all start brain hacking? Are we going to get amazing network effects and just have much more awesome conversations and be more productive as a society? Or is there a possible dystopian future associated with cognitive enhancement?
Do you mean the Darth Vader problem?
Yes.
If you don't take care of the ethical and emotional parts of your brain before you deal with the really powerful parts, you can be a real asshole, to be perfectly honest. Really, really smart jerks are worse than really dumb jerks. So you should spend some time and energy not being a jerk. I know I had a lot of work to do on that, and I'm fortunate that I actually did that first, maybe just through serendipity, because with great power comes great responsibility, I would say. And as you become more smart and more capable and your brain turns all the way on, you can do more bad things if that's the way you're wired.
I mean,
can you turn all the mics on again?
Let's see this. Okay. I'd put in my two cents that, you know, we do live in a world where we're dealing with these issues on a daily basis with drugs. And frankly, you know, I think collectively bioethicists and as a society, we're beginning to understand how things should be used in this context and at least processing some of these issues. I'm not concerned about a dystopian future. What really resonates with me is, Megan, you talked about how we're always pushing a little bit. And I think I don't see this as a state change or qualitatively different. I see this as part of that same advance.
Okay, questions?
I had one. My sister has chronic fatigue, and I forget the other name for that type of stuff. She's had it for a number of years, and it does affect the brain. Are there any things that you know of that are good for a person with chronic fatigue?
Chronic fatigue?
Anybody?
I can take it.
I
actually had chronic fatigue and Lyme disease and fibromyalgia, too.
Yeah, fibromyalgia.
Yeah, basically look at mitochondrial function, which, funny enough, if you fix that throughout the body, it fixes it in your brain as well. So it's probably a longer discussion here, but you can address things that typically make the cells in the brain work better, make the cells in the body work better as well, and that will increase your performance whether or not you have chronic fatigue.
Thank you.
Maybe I missed part of the discussion a little bit, but because I came in a little late. But you really have no ethical concerns at all about this? I'm going to make a couple of dorky references, so just go ahead and excuse me. But I'm kind of a paladin by nature, and I feel like there's a lot of room for abuse here, more like the Star Trek Khan-esque aspect of like hacking to the point where, you know, people can't abuse it. So I was just kind of wondering what your feelings are about that.
Did anybody catch it?
Do you mean like advertising or something different?
No. I mean, like, if this is a sort of thing, like, you know, you can change the way your brain functions. That, I mean, aren't you concerned about people changing the way brains function of other people, not even just themselves? Is that a valid concern, or is this kind of off topic?
No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I'm sorry, it's a little hard for us to hear some of the questions there. That's why we're peering with our ears, if you will.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's actually a much more important bioethical issue than things that one is doing to oneself.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's something that we'll have to be even more careful about. I mean, there's obvious potential ethical issues if certain devices are being used to reduce recidivism in prison populations, or if minors or people with intellectual disabilities are being forced to use something that they don't assent or consent to. So personally, I think that's something we need to just be a lot more careful of.
No, it's very fascinating for sure. But I mean, like, you know, there are things in the UK where they've done things like given vitamins to prisoners and things like that to lower the violence. And it's worked, and that's been great. But I just worry about the other end of that. So that was my question. So, cool. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to see laws actually in place about what you can do to someone else cognitively. We don't have a cognitive bill of rights. We ought to have one.
It's a super fascinating talk, and thank you all for kind of taking the time to present this. I am a biohacker as well, but I was wondering, and this is kind of for Asprey, have you experimented with smart drugs, and have you looked at the efficacy between some of your...
That is a big can of worms.
I'm not looking for the efficacy, like, back and forth. Those drugs, like, some of them have... Like plenty of clinical data.
And we do not give medical advice in this forum.
And I don't want to. Exactly. And I don't want to open that can of worms. Only to say, have you investigated the efficacy or the success rate among both types of treatment, whether it's, you know, kind of training yourself versus, you know...
I would point you to a blog post I wrote titled "Why You May Be Suffering from a Modafinil Deficiency."
Okay, that's the answer. All right.
Modafinil being the smart drug that's most like the one in Limitless, for those of you who don't know it.
Hi, my name is Ryan Meyer. Thank you guys for a fascinating talk. Mike, you mentioned sensory processing at the base of your pyramid earlier. Sensory processing and being governed...
Can you get a little closer to the mic?
Absolutely. Mike, you mentioned sensory processing at the base of your pyramid earlier, and sensory processing being governed by the vestibular system. Do any of you know of studies showing a causal relationship between vestibular performance and cognitive performance?
And people, by improving your vestibular sense, you can certainly get better at sense of direction and things like that. I don't know of anything... any specific research that shows a connection between that and types of... what I think you're asking about is more like intelligence and memory and some other areas of more general cognitive performance. Yeah, I'm not aware of anything.
I'm working with another biohacker. Actually, I'm putting on a conference where we do live training with people. But it turns out if you increase your vestibular abilities, you can increase the myelination of the nerves. And when you do that, your reaction time improves dramatically, and it appears to have significant cognitive effects, but I don't know of like a third-party study about that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. I'm just going to go right for the can of worms. Neurological improvement through like illegal drugs, like mushrooms, LSD, there's lots of scientific evidence that show, like, for example, that LSD increases compassion, reduces, violent intentions and so forth, but, you know, they're illegal, so you can't really do much scientific research in that area. Any thoughts on that?
They're not illegal in Amsterdam.
It's true.
And they work.
I think that research is starting to reemerge in the recent years, actually. It was kind of, you know, had the backlash in the 60s and 70s. A lot of the experiments were pretty unethical. And then that's also when a lot of these drugs became recreational. But because of the potential that was recognized 50 years ago, there is, I think, increasingly more and more research happening on the psychedelic drugs for treatment of addiction and emotional well-being and things like that.
Cool, thanks.
Well, one thought there too. Stan Grof, who treated 10,000 people with LSD as part of a licensed psychiatric treatment facility in the 50s and 60s, when LSD was made illegal, he invented a yogic breathing technique that makes you hallucinate and gives you the same type of therapeutic benefits that you get from taking LSD, and that's available today. I've actually done holotropic breathing with Stan Grof twice now. Very, actually, heavier experiences than you will get from taking most hallucinogens, including ayahuasca in the Amazon, which I've also done. So there's meat on that bone, so to speak.
It's a question for Dave. I think you mentioned during the talk that you had Asperger's, or still have Asperger's. Is there anything in particular? No? Did I?
I'm looking right at you. Asperger's. Right here.
Right. Okay. So the question is, I have a couple friends with Asperger's. Is there anything in particular, like in the lit or in the brain hack stuff, that helps for that and for autism?
It turns out most of the things I talked about will improve that. Just breathing exercises, like the heart math stuff, has a proven effect. Neurofeedback is profoundly important. And also, eating enough healthy fat in your diet does a lot. So there's a whole bunch of neuroimmune things. I didn't mention it. I have a book coming out from Wiley this year called The Better Baby Book. That's a complete guide to using nutrition and these types of things during pregnancy to prevent the neuroinflammation that's behind autism in the first place. So there's a lot of studies there, but it's outside the time we have to answer it. But hit me up afterwards. I'll give you the recipes.
Yeah, I actually have a slightly different perspective on that, which I think there are a lot of areas where there's a lot of promise for things like Asperger's, but there's not a lot of, you know, well-run, controlled studies that can tell us, you know, what works better than other things. I think a lot of it so far has been more anecdotal, which is great. I mean, if you can cure your own problems, then you're there. But there's less known from a sort of group level science point of view.
And sorry, I'm going to also throw in one other point there. I mean, for me, there's an important difference between cure and treat, right? I mean, we haven't cured HIV/AIDS, but we can treat people with HIV/AIDS so they live healthy lives for a long time. And so similarly with autism and Asperger's, there are many technologies emerging that will help treat the symptoms. For instance, sensory integration and sensory processing that completely revolutionized the lives of families without curing anything necessarily.
Cool. I think this next question is mostly for Dave, but if you other gentlemen have some inclination to answer, please do. I'm curious about any experiments with the pineal gland, especially to increase the amounts of DMT naturally occurring in the brain. Have you guys experimented with that? And if so, have you seen any direct correlation to bringing the subconscious forward in your work?
As far as I know, there's only two times in your life when you normally use DMT, and that's when you're born and when you die. The rest of the time, our production of DMT, as I understand it, isn't particularly there. We have neuroscientists here who know more about that. I've used DMT in the form of ayahuasca, and I've done a lot of pineal gland stimulation electrically and with light, and certainly there's meditative things you can experience there, but other than that, don't have a great answer. Do you guys...
I don't have a lot to add on that one. I'm going to defer to you, Dave.
Everything I know is from Fear and Loathing.
And just and just one little other part, Dave. When you have experimented with the pineal gland with technology to stimulate it, have you found any results?
You know, it starts to get into like more Kundalini yoga sorts of things, but you know, there's something that you can feel that happens on your spinal cord and how you quantify and, you know, bring it into the Western world. I don't know, but yeah, there's results.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Hi. This is a question, again, I guess, mainly for Dave. On the DIY side, do you have any specifics you could provide, especially on the CES, the far infrared, and the laser? I've seen the TCDS stuff, but those others I haven't...
In terms of the DIY side, I actually mentioned the beam width and the 808, I think, nanometers for the FIR LED that's used there. That was on the slide. The laser stuff, I have that on the blog. That one that I have in the picture is called a Q1000. It's mixed ruby and infrared, and it turns out the pulse rate of the laser is very important for its biological effects. I'm a big fan of quantified self. I was just interviewed on the podcast from the editor of Make magazine, so if you can solder these at home, you should.
Cool, thanks.
Mr. Asprey, you said earlier how dual in-back sucks, kind of. And it does, and I've been working to fix that, but I feel like with every tweak I make or improvement, I move further away from the established research. And then there's data like Mr. Scanlon presented earlier, but it seems like there's so many giant black boxes of unexplored area where two drinks may be the optimum rate in terms of correlating with how people do on this test, but who knows how or why. And I'm wondering, I suppose, how you see the narrowness of scientific research reconciling with the broad range of technological possibility as time goes on.
Big data and the quantified self movement are going to kick science's ass. The reason for that is that we'll have these little black boxes that we come up with in controlled laboratories, and then we'll get data from, 10 million people who tried it, and it didn't freaking work. Mm-hmm. For instance, eat less and work out more to lose weight, and when I weighed 300 pounds, it didn't work. But we have enough data out there now to show that, what do you know, I did 4,500 calories a day for 2 years and lost weight without exercise. So we know that what the black box said was a lie. And it wasn't an intentional lie, it was an honest mistake someone made mixed with politics. So the same things are going to happen where some established doctrines are going to really be challenged because the real world that we can now measure instead of anecdotally but quantitatively is going to be very different than what we think it is. And that's going to be fun.
Thank you.
Yeah, and to clarify, I mean, science likes data. That's the difference between a DIY sort of self-hacking where you have an N of one and scientific approach looks at an entire group. And this is, you bring up a really important point and limitation of the world in cognitive training so far, which is that most of these things, including dual NVAC and dozens of other specific tasks that improve a specific ability, are kind of shots in the dark. Those were invented by somebody that had a theory based on imperfect information, and then you have an idea, you put it together and test it and find out what it does. But each of these things is like a little point. It's a little speck of light in a dark room. And that has really held up the field, I think, of cognitive training. That's the one that I'm most into. And what I think that you will see in the future is because of big data, because of lots of people being interested in this, the purpose of the Lumosity Human Cognition Project is to make sense of the 20 million people that are doing cognitive training now so that we can look at 40 different training activities at once or more and begin to correlate what types of training, what types of activities end up leading to different types of results. So we don't need to necessarily go in with an a priori hypothesis of exactly what will cause exactly what. Instead, we can look retroactively at a whole large set of different types of behavior and see what drives the behavior that we want. But it's really early, I would say, that, kind of tip of the iceberg in terms of training behaviors.
We have time for two more questions, so come up with something really awesome.
So I'm glad that question just came about the big data, and I have a question for Mike in particular. When I was looking at your data, in particular the one with the hours of sleep versus the raindrop counting,
yep.
The thing I noticed is at the very peak, your error bars were the smallest. So your uncertainty is the smallest, and that's about the average amount of hours that people get for sleep. So I'm guessing that your errors are primarily statistical in nature. And if it's instead of the spread, because your spread was so small on that point at the top, it didn't seem reasonable that it was actually a spread of the averages, that it was primarily dominated by statistical uncertainties. And because of that, I'm concerned actually that your other uncertainties on all those other correlations aren't taken into effect. And my concern actually is, I hate to do this towards the end, but on a note of skepticism, the amount of data that's out there now doesn't mean that we get right answers out of it, because if you don't treat uncertainties and even uncertainties on the correlations properly, you can tune on statistical fluctuations. So again, maybe you can make some statement about how you're actually calculating your uncertainties and how you're treating these things, because to be honest with you, I'm not sure if I trust that data you had based on your error bars.
So there are two things there. One is the error bar there is smaller because you have a lot more people that end up doing seven hours.
Right, so that's just root n.
And
But right. that's different from systematic errors when you've got some large spread and all those other things with the amount of drinks that they have and all that.
So I think the important part is that it's a correlation. The stats there are fine, but it's important to recognize how it's limited. And that is that we don't know what is causing these differences. It's likely that people...
But I'm not even clear that they're distances. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think maybe I'm not getting my point about it. My point is that if you calculate your uncertainties, maybe they're not differences. They're actually not that different amongst those other parameters besides sleep.
Okay, running out of time though, so let's.
All right, I'm sorry.
Agree to disagree.
Maybe there's a better question to end on though than details of statistics.
Let's have one more question to end on.
Hey guys, just real quickly, I forget what it was called, but there was that sort of generational improvement of IQ that you talked about. And I was wondering if you had just had seen any studies or had any thoughts on possible epigenetic factors in that improvement.
My whole book is the How to Use Epigenetics to Have Smarter Kids. Yeah. It's got 1,300 references in it, betterbabybook.com. It's not published yet, but it's finished being written. We're just waiting on Wiley to pick a date. So there definitely are intelligence effects from epigenetics out there. There are definitely a lot of questions we don't have answered, but there are some pretty obvious things you can draw from biochemistry and all that says before and during pregnancy, you should do these things, and you're very likely to have kids who are smarter and even grandkids and great-grandkids who are smarter and healthier, and we can actually transform our species that way without doing bizarre implanted electrodes and strange genetic engineering. It's natural that way.
Cool.
Cool. Thank you so much, everyone. It was really fun.